Well, you may be a journalist and writer, but you're no stranger to the microphone either, are you? You're not nervous, are you?
Hardly.
Well, I want to ask you about China and Tiananmen Diary and ask you a few questions about yourself as well. But let's talk about the book first. You had gone to China, a place you know well, of course, with a Japanese television crew to make a documentary. Tell me how you happened to be in China and how this documentary developed and why you were there at this particular time.
Well, it was a coincidence getting to China when we did. We'd been working on this documentary, which was supposed to be running and will be running in connection with the 40th anniversary of the People's Republic, which comes up on the 1st of October. And we've done a lot of work outside of China, interviews and things of that kind. We scheduled ourselves to go into China after the Gorbachev visit, thinking that by that time the Chinese would be free of the of all the problems connected with that visit, and they could pay a lot of attention to us. And so our arrival date was set for the 25th of May. Of course, there was a lot of tension, as you know, in China during the early part of the year, and when we came up toward that date, the Chinese kept saying, well, maybe you ought to delay a little bit until things quiet down a bit, and we did delay a wee bit. And I said, well, let's go on in, because if we keep delaying, first thing you know, the time will be up and we won't get the thing done. So we said we'd come on in. We came in on the 2nd of June, which, as it turns out, was 2 days before the Tiananmen massacre, which, of course, we had no prior knowledge of. It was sheer coincidence that we got in there, and a psychological moment, of course, to be in China.
Of course, you are well known in China. I think your book, The Long March, is one of China's all-time bestsellers, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I don't know that it's an all-time bestseller. I should think that maybe Chairman Mao's little red book topped The Long March.
A little bit, maybe.
Yeah, but it was translated and published and it sold very widely, and I am indeed well-known because the book is well-known there. That really had nothing to do with my being there, except possibly when I went over to Tiananmen Square, as I did the day before it all happened, and was talking to the students and the demonstrators who were gathered there, and there were certainly not an awful lot of them there. Several of them recognized me from the book and the jacket photograph and wanted my autograph, so I found myself after the massacre in the funny position of thinking of those autographs which I'd signed a few hours before the bullets started flying, and wondering how many of these youngsters had a bullet in the head or in their chest, and in their pocket was a little autograph signed by Harrison Salisbury. Weird sort of feeling.
Yeah. In a way, you lucked out. You stayed at the Hotel Beijing.
Well, that, of course, that was a matter of luck as far as the Tiananmen was concerned, because, as you may know, the Beijing Hotel is right on Chang'an Avenue, the main boulevard that leads into the square. It's down about a block, a little bit more. And I had a front room suite with a balcony looking out where I could look right up to the square, so that when things started happening, they happened right outside my window, and I did have a front row seat.
But the square, I believe you report in the book, I believe you say it's the largest square in the world.
It is. It's 100 acres. If you can believe such an expanse of pavement, it's even bigger than Red Square. It's bigger than any square here. It's bigger than St. Peter's Square in Rome. I think the Chinese deliberately made that. It wasn't that big before the revolution. Before Mao came in 1949, it was a sort of a crummy little square with a lot of ill-assorted buildings filling it up. There was room for enough people to gather in it, but it must have been perhaps one-tenth of the size it is now. And one of the first things that the communists did when they established their regime was to tear down a lot of these old buildings and widen up the square. And then for the 10th anniversary, that is to say in 1959, they made it the present size and put up the great big Great Hall of the People on one side and two great big museums on the other side, so that it did give them an enormous space. And it was there that Mao, in the days of the Cultural Revolution, used to take the cheers and greetings of the Red Guards, who would assemble by the million in that square. The square will hold, apparently, I don't know that anybody's counted this, but they estimate it will hold at least 1 million people.
Now, you were in the hotel preparing for the documentary. When did you have an inkling that something was wrong on the outside?
I had a little feeling the night we got there, which was a Friday. I've often stayed in the Peking Hotel, and I know something about the pattern of traffic on Chang'an Street outside. And I woke up in the night, and it was deathly still. And I had never encountered that before, because ordinarily there's always traffic on that street. It's the main street in town, practically speaking. There are trucks going by and buses and some kind of traffic, and this was deathly still. And so I got up and looked out the window, and I saw that there was no wheeled traffic on the street. There were bicycles. I shouldn't say no wheeled traffic. There were bicycles and people walking, but no motor vehicles. So I thought, well, that's funny. I don't understand why. And there'd been all the rumors that maybe something would happen in Tiananmen Square. Absolutely dead quiet, so it didn't seem as though there could be anything there. But it bothered me somewhat, and I got up early in the morning and went over to the square to see, indeed, what was going on. And I found that something had happened during the night. I didn't know what, because I couldn't speak Chinese, but I sensed immediately by the people talking in little knots and so forth that they were talking about something that had happened. And I also found that there was a barricade of buses which had been put across the street, which prevented access to the square. And that was, of course, the reason why there'd been no traffic. And pretty soon I bumped into a fellow newspaper man, an Englishman, and he told me that there had been all kinds of alarms and excursions during the night, and there'd been a lot of troop movements, none of which had reached the square, and none of which had produced serious confrontations, but in many cases where the troops had been surrounded by swarms of people who begged them to not to fire on the people and to go back to their barracks, and indeed, these troops had gone back. This man had been up all night chasing around on those things, and so that gave me some notion that there was something in motion, and that there was reason for the apprehension that maybe the troops would move in on the square. I went over and looked at the square that morning. It was not prepossessing at all. I mean, it was quiet. Not very many people around, at least that you could see. The goddess of freedom was standing up there in the middle, and there were all the cluster of tents and young people sort of wandering around. It was a rather lackadaisical atmosphere. A lot of people were going around munching those big buns that the Beijing people eat.
Parenthetically, how long had the students been occupying that square?
Well, they'd been there in the square since sometime in April. It was a month and a half anyway, or maybe 6 or 7 weeks that they'd been in the square. Lots of people had said the square was very dirty and smelled bad and all that sort of thing. By that time, at least, it didn't seem so to me. I didn't smell any smells at all that morning. In fact, the air for Beijing, which often is full of dust and dirt, was very fresh. And it was a lovely, lovely early summer morning. And the last thing that you could imagine, or the last thing that I imagined, was that within a few hours there would be gunshots and people being killed and all kinds of things of that kind happening.
You can hear these gunshots from your window. You heard the gunshots firing from your window.
Yes, I went to bed rather early on Saturday night because I'd been up a lot on the night before and traveling and all that sort of thing, so I went to bed early. And the first thing I knew, I half awoke with the impression of having heard very heavy outburst of gunfire. But I was so sleepy, I just turned over, and I woke up again probably a very few minutes thereafter. And indeed, there was firing going on in the direction of the square. So I got up and went out on my balcony to see what I could see. And I couldn't see the actual firing in the square, but I saw lots of people running back and forth in front of the hotel, and some on bicycles and some not, and shouting, and cheers were going up as though there were some kind of a battle going on, or a game. I didn't think it was a game, though. And then the firing opened up again, coming from the square, and I realized that these bullets were flying right down in front of me and around me, and some of them were hitting the wall of the hotel. So I decided that perhaps it was not the best thing to do to be leaning out that window with the bullets flying around, so I withdrew a little bit. And as I did that, I heard this enormous sound, which turned out to be one of these big armored columns of tanks, led by tanks, and then armored troop carriers, and it came roaring down Chang'an Street and firing as it came down. And I didn't know at the start what they were firing at. I later realized that they were firing rounds into the intersection of the street below the hotel before they arrived at the hotel, where there was another one of these barricades of buses and people standing around. And as the night wore on, I realized that this was their pattern, as they would come up, and there were several of these columns that came up. From a couple of blocks away, they would fire several rounds into the intersection, obviously to clear people away, and then move on, and they would crunch over some of the buses and some of the machines, cars that were in the barricades, and then come roaring right down past the hotel, sometimes firing again, and sometimes waiting until they were a little past the hotel, and then firing, as it seemed to me, into the square itself. And I was very puzzled by that, because I thought they must have control of the square, but this suggested that there might be a battle going on. So I turned on my little shortwave radio and got a report from VOA, which said that the troops had come into the square and had fired on the students and were in possession of it. So I still don't know exactly what they were firing at. In fact, a great deal of the gunfire that I heard that night, and it went all that night and through the next day, seemed to me to be aimless fire, which was probably designed as much to terrorize as to kill. But since it was spraying down the street in both directions, they frequently killed people as well. And as it was estimated by one of my Chinese friends who went out and went up to the square, which was dangerous to do with all this firing, he spotted about 100 bodies at the end of the day of people who were killed between the hotel and the square in these crowds that moved back and forth. I myself saw a couple of people killed right outside, right under my window in the middle of the square, just ordinary citizens as far as I could tell. There was no way of designating. They didn't look like students anyway. And that sort of thing went on for hour after hour after hour. I'm a veteran of World War II, that is, I was a war correspondent in World War II, and I heard a lot of gunfire in various places, but I don't know when I've heard such concentrated heavy machine gun fire, automatic rifle fire from AK-47s, and then light cannon fire. And that puzzles me. That still puzzles me. What they were using the cannons for, whether they were shooting at these barricades or shooting at each other, or they certainly couldn't have been shooting at the students with cannons.
Well, you were effectively trapped in that hotel, and some of the source of your information came from, as you mentioned, the VOA and the BBC.
It was an odd feeling to stand there right beside that window, hearing the gunfire and knowing that there was a battle or something going on in Tiananmen Square, and then turning on the radio and finding out from VOA or BBC what it was that was happening, coming all the way from London or Washington, the reports having gone back and forth and coming to me, whereas I could only guess at what was going on up there.
Well, CBS News had a couple of correspondents in the square, and they have a new device called a cell phone that doesn't take wires, and that's how CBS was able to report a lot of on-the-scene description using these cell phones.
Well, it was absolutely magnificent, the kind of reporting that went on as far as CBS is concerned, and all the different agencies and the broadcast systems, and CNN, which was very good on it. I think CBS and CNN did the best job, without any question, of reporting on the square. And it required, in addition to all this technical stuff, which was magnificent and magical, a lot of guts and bravery and foolhardiness on the part of the reporters. I mean, some of the chances that they took to get that stuff just make your hair rise on end.
Now, you write in your diary that at some point you had to decide whether or not to continue on with the documentary.
Yes.
So it came time to leave Beijing, and you have a very exciting description of your leaving in a car from the hotel. Tell me about that.
Well, this was a very unusual thing. We discovered sometime on Sunday, after the massacre had occurred that Sunday, early that Sunday morning, that there were barricades all around the hotel and military patrolling and gunfire, and that we were actually besieged within the enclave, and there was no access to the hotel. There was no way of getting in or out except perhaps on foot. And we had decided by that time that to work on this documentary, it was impossible to do any work in Beijing, and we might as well, we had a program of going out into the countryside, and that we might as well get out of Beijing and go on that. But the problem was to get out of the Peking Hotel. And nobody was willing to drive their taxi or their car or the minibus into the hotel because of the danger of the gunfire. And also they were frankly afraid that demonstrators would seize the vehicle and toss it on one of these barricades, because that's what they were doing. That's the way they made these barricades. So we didn't know whether we could get out. But finally, to our good luck, on Monday morning, the CCTV, the Chinese television agency, which we're acting as our liaison, did come up with a minibus with a very experienced driver. And he was courageous enough to come into the hotel and then take us out. And we couldn't go by any regular route. The only way of getting out was to go through the hutongs, which are those narrow alleys which surround or make up most of the central district of Beijing. And he had to pick his way through these narrow streets, which were just about wide enough for our bus, and find some way that would escape all the barricades and barriers and things of that kind. And it meant that you would go down one of these narrow streets and you come to a dead end and you have to back up and come down another one. And one place we were completely blocked because there was a Toyota parked, well, it was disabled right in the middle of the hutong. We couldn't get around it. Fortunately, we had these very strong, bright, young Japanese photographers in the car, and they all leapt out and they literally lifted this car over to a side and put it in a little enclave just wide enough so we could get by it. It took us about an hour to get through these alleyways until we finally found a place where we could get, we were out of the central part of town, and we connected with one of the arterial highways leading out toward the airport, and we were able to get on that, and with some difficulty, there were two barricades that we had difficulty getting around. They were still burning. We got past those and out to the airport where we found ourselves practically isolated. Nobody else, there were a lot of people wanting to get out of town, but they couldn't get out there. And we went out there and got our plane finally after waiting for hours and hours for it, and got out of town and went on to Wuhan and other places in the countryside where we had planned to shoot pictures. And incidentally, it gave us a chance to see how the countryside was reacting to what was happening in Beijing and what they knew about it.
And in fact, they did know about it, didn't they?
Yes, they did know about it because the students had been very clever and very swift. They'd utilized the magnificent Chinese telephone system, state-of-the-art, just imported from the French telephone company, and they'd communicated all around the country and got the word out within hours of what happened in Tiananmen. Everybody knew out in the countryside, and then the students went out and had mass meetings and on Sunday afternoon and told the people what had happened. And this is one reason why the government story that nobody was killed in Tiananmen and nothing really happened there didn't go down very well, because the people already knew what had really happened there.
Well, I'm going to get back to China. I want to ask you a couple of questions about yourself. For you, Harrison Salisbury, where did it all begin?
When, where, how?
The old newspaper phrases.
Well, I tell you, I think that the origin of all this trouble really...
No, wait. I mean, I'm talking about you now. I want to get back
to China.
Oh, talking
about me. Oh, well, I first went to China I first got into China itself in 1972, which is relatively recent. That was after President Nixon made his trip. I'd been trying for years to get permission to get into China, but as you know, our relations were very bad with China, and the Chinese were not letting any American correspondents into the country. But beginning with 72, and from that time forward, I made very frequent trips to China, each time related generally to some project or book or something of that kind, the most important of those being a very long trip I made in 84 getting material on the Long March that Mao and the Red Army had made in the mid-30s, 6,000 miles across some of the awfulest country you ever saw. I followed that route and got the story from observations myself and from interviewing the survivors. A really fantastic story which hadn't been told before.
How did you get into journalism?
Huh? Journalism?
Yeah.
You know, I've been in journalism all my life, really, so it seems. I was working on my hometown newspaper midway in my college career, and I got kicked out of the university. I was an editor of the
university. What school was that?
The University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I was editor of the school paper, and I was a very uppity editor and offended the authorities, and so they threw me out. And that got my first job with the United Press, as it was then, because...
Wait a minute. They threw you out of the paper or out of the college?
Out of the paper. Out of the college. I was expelled from the university.
What happened?
Well, I ran a very sort of feisty paper challenging the authorities on many different things, and they just got sick of it. It was a legislative year, the year the legislature approves the budget for the University of Minnesota, and I was proving very embarrassing to them by exposing what I regarded, and some other people did too, some kind of doddering practices by the Board of Regents and the university, and so they got rid of me.
We've had it with you, Salisbury.
Yeah, that's right. But as it happened, the UPI carried a story on this, which they circulated around the country, and about 2 weeks later, one of their people quit in their St. Paul bureau. And the chief thought, well, gee, I bet I know somebody who's available. And he called me up because he figured I was out of school and out of a job. And he hired me. And so I went to work for the United Press, and I've been a professional newspaperman ever since. That year was about 1930.
So how long were you with the United Press?
About 18 years.
And you became a correspondent, so you began traveling.
I became a correspondent. I went to Europe in World War II as a war correspondent, and I eventually wound up as Moscow bureau chief for UP. And then when I shifted over to the Times after the war, I went in to Moscow again as correspondent, this time for the New York Times, and spent 6 years there.
Have you spent most of your career overseas?
I suppose my career has been about 50-50. I've spent a great deal of time abroad, but I've usually been based in the United States and gone abroad maybe for 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, but coming back to the United States and doing lots of reporting in this country. It's been, I think, from a professional standpoint and a personal standpoint, an ideal sort of life of having the best of being a foreign correspondent and a national correspondent and sometimes a local writer.
Now, how long were you with the Times?
25 years.
When did you leave the Times?
I left the Times about, in 75.
75.
Yeah.
And I was looking at your credits here.
Yeah.
You have something like...
I've written a lot of books.
You have something like 20 books here.
Yeah.
How did you find the time? You had a full-time job as a newspaper man?
Well, I tell you, I've always been a fast writer, let's put it that way. And I, over the years, I utilized the spare time I had, which would be weekends or vacations, to write books. And since I left the Times, I have written even more because it gave me a chance to catch up on various book contracts that I hadn't fulfilled for several years.
I see that the focus of your books has been on the Soviet Union.
Yes.
And most recently,
very
China.
Naturally, because of my long years in the Soviet Union, and I know the Russian language, and I consider myself a Soviet specialist. And China has come along as a new girl in town. In the last 15, 20 years, I've been focusing on China, but I don't know the language. I haven't lived in the country. I've just traveled very extensively, but I don't regard myself as sound on China as I am on the Soviet Union.
Don't they have a phrase for you? It's called an old Russian hand. Is that the phrase?
Well, I don't know. They call them old China hands. I don't know about old Russian hands. Usually they talk about the Russians as criminologists.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm a criminologist.
Well, this tragedy in Beijing happened in June. Here it is, the 1st of September. How in the world could this book be published so quickly?
Well, I'll tell you how that book could be published so quickly. It was the combined effort of the publisher and the author I kept an actual, it is Tiananmen diary, and it is an actual diary which I kept line by line while I was in Beijing, and while I was at that window looking out on Chang'an Street, I would jot down what I saw, and I kept that. And on my way back from China, I copied off my notes, so I had them about half copied off, and fleshed them out a little bit with background. And I arrived in New York with that Tiananmen diary about half written. And I called up Roger Donald, my editor at Little Brown, and said, are you interested? And he had, turned out it had the same idea, and he already was interested and had made arrangements if I wanted to do such a book. And he did arrange to do something which Little Brown doesn't do, I think, and that was to produce an instant book. I turned in my manuscript to, well, he came over to my house and edited that manuscript himself personally, and we had it completed and turned into the printer by the 1st of July. The printer had books available about the 1st of August. Now, that is less than 2 months after the event, and that is something which I don't think has ever happened in Little Brown's history. But it is an instant book, and it was an instant, I mean, after all, this is an event which we all saw on television. We all, our emotions were all aroused. We all feel that we know something of it, that we're part of it. And here is the account of the way it seemed to one person who was actually in the middle of it.
Do you think that we will ever know how many people were killed in that massacre?
No, I don't think so. I don't think we will ever know. I think we know fairly well how many were killed. I think that in the square itself and around the square on the edges, there were probably as much as 400 per people, students largely, and some ordinary citizens killed. I think overall in the fighting in Beijing, particularly in the entry of those armored columns into the city from the western suburbs and some from the east, that there were probably another couple of thousand or maybe more people killed by these columns that just charged right through dense throngs of people with their guns going. And I have had eyewitness descriptions of two of those encounters, one of which the young man, whom I think is very reliable, thought at least 1,000 people were killed. So I suppose that the total would be, let's say, between 2,000 and 3,000. But we will not know the exact figures. The Chinese are not giving out any exact totals. And we also know, again, from first-hand witnesses, that many people who were killed and lay beside the roads, the troops came along and just poured gasoline over them and incinerated them on the spot. And there is very good evidence that a certain number in the square were burned as well. There was a fire burned in that square for nearly 2 days after the shooting. And the authorities say, well, we were just burning up the rubbish. But one of the PLA, the army people, admitted that some bodies were put in that funeral pyre. So I don't think we're going to know the exact numbers. After all, they say nobody was killed.
Well, I think, didn't they say on television that there may have been 23 deaths?
Yes, yes. They said there may have been 23. I think they said 23 students and then a few other people. But they have publicized since the occasion, they put great emphasis on the number of PLA, of army people who were killed. And a certain number of army people were killed.
And now they showed you were outraged as you watched television to see these films of these army trucks burning.
That's right. That's right.
But you raised the question that the PLA may have done it to themselves.
Well, this is a question that is still on my mind, and I don't suppose I'll ever get that entirely resolved, because the PLA insists that those columns were trapped and that the ordinary people came in and tossed Molotov cocktails in each one of those vehicles and burned them up. But you see a column of 25 or 30 vehicles all in a row, each one of them sort of uniformly burned. And I just wonder if the people had that many Molotov cocktails available and that efficiency to burn all those vehicles out.
Well, when these students began to demonstrate, it seemed as though things were really changing in China for the better. And all of a sudden, this tragedy happened. That's a major setback for China. What's going to happen in the future, do you think?
Well, it is a terrible setback. It's a terrible tragedy for the Chinese. It's not only a tragedy for the people who were killed and all that, but so far as their plans and their program for going forward and the Deng Xiaoping's own program for what he called reform and opening to the outside world, it's all gone. And they invested 10 years of erratic but really quite effective work at getting themselves out of the almost medieval conditions they were left in by Mao. And that's come to a dead end. Whether they're going to be able to pick up on it again, I don't know. But they're doing such non-productive things as beginning to close down the private businesses that they'd encouraged to develop. They're harassing the students. Maybe they're not throwing them all into prison and shooting them, although a certain number certainly have been. But now they have cut the size of the universities in half, closed out all of their social departments, history, political science, English, languages, all that has been closed down. Students can enter the university, but they have to go and serve in the army before they can go to classes. And when they get through, they have to go out and serve in the countryside, feeding pigs for a couple of years. And now the government has issued an edict that none of them are to be hired by the government when they graduate. So it seems to me that this is a case of really jabbing out your eye because you don't like what you see, because they are the students and an educated group of specialists is what China needs more than any other thing if she's ever going to get into the modern age. And they are depriving themselves of that in order to punish and harass the students, and I think in order to satisfy the feelings of revenge of a bunch of old men whose minds are not operating in a very logical manner.
Well, Harrison Salisbury, my last question, when do you expect to go back to China?
I don't expect to go back to China probably for some considerable time because, as you can imagine, I have spoken very frankly in Tiananmen Diary about my views of Deng Xiaoping and General Yang Shangkun and the others and what they've done. I've expressed the same sentiments in articles in the New York Times, and I don't believe that they are very well taken in Beijing, so I may have to wait until the geriatric generation is gone before I go back.
Harrison Salisbury, thank you very much.
Thank you.